Hello, I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch, and it's time to turn to today's obituaries from the Des Moines Register. June Ross of Des Moines. Mary June Ross was born June 1, 1922, to Ruth and Claude Rucker in Pullman, Washington. She lived most of her early years in the Palouse country and attended Washington State College. She was a performance music major and was blessed with a soaring soprano voice. June met her future husband, Homer Ross, while singing in a quartet at Washington State. She always said he married her because he walked her home across campus and he laughed at her jokes. They were married during World War II in August of 1942. They both worked intermittently for Boeing and went on to graduate from WSC in 1950 after Homer served stateside in the Army Air Force. When Homer was rehired at Boeing, they moved to Seattle and started a family. 8 years later, they were transferred to the Mojave Desert for a year. In the meantime, they had purchased their property on Vashon Island. Then in 1961, they moved a mobile home to Ross Inlet on Quartermaster Harbor and later built a house there. June loved to sing, play the cello, and was a voracious reader. She had a tremendous sense of humor, adored animals, and could identify most native plants. June helped with school activities for her girls, sang in many choirs, was a 4-H chaperone, and started the Quartermaster Bookshop with Grace Burton in 1964. June and Homer were active in the Methodist Church and the Quartermaster Yacht Club. June was a first mate with Homer on their sailboats and enjoyed exploring and birdwatching as they traveled the inland islands waters of the Salish Sea. She returned to college in the 1970s to learn more about computers and worked as a bookkeeper for three different small businesses on Vashon Island. In the mid-1980s, June and Homer downsized and moved to a condominium in Tacoma. After Homer died in 1989, she moved into the Wesley Homes retirement community in Des Moines. June was a choir director and the librarian and had many close friends during the 26 years that she lived there. She spent her final 2 years in an adult family home in Renton, where she died peacefully on September 5th. Her family misses her very much, especially her acceptance, compassion, and generosity for family and friends. June was preceded in death by her parents, her beloved husband, and her favorite brother, Jack Rucker. She is survived by her daughters, Claudia and husband Al Ross Weston, and Shelley, husband Dean Conti, and granddaughters Heather Conti, Sarah Conti, Nikki Weston, and Sandy Weston. Also survived by sister-in-law Evelyn Rucker, nieces and nephews Linda, Vicky, Jolynn, David, Andrea, Paul, three grandnieces, and three great-granddaughters. Donations can be made in June's memory to the Vashon Food Bank, Vashon Friends of the Library, Vashon Presbyterian Church, or the Vashon United Methodist Church. We hope to have a celebration of her life on June 1st, if circumstances permit. Mary Erin Holtz of Harlan. Services for Mary Erin Holtz, 78, who died on November 22nd. Visitation will be held Saturday, November 28th, from 11 a.m. to noon at the Polly Jones Funeral Home in Harlan. Private families for funeral services will be on Saturday, November 28th, with interment at Union Township Cemetery in Defiance, Iowa. James Diebelbriess of West Liberty. James E. Diebelbriess, age 87, of West Liberty, passed away November 24th in Iowa City. The family will participate in a private memorial service with a celebration of life at a later date. The Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Liberty is caring for Jim's family. Memorials may be made to the West Liberty Rescue Unit or the Simpson Memorial Home. Carl Jurgensen. Services for Carl Jurgensen, age 85, of rural Churden, will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, December 1st, at the Trinity Lutheran Church in Jefferson, with burial in the Highland Cemetery in Churden. Visitation is from 10:30 to 11 a.m. at the church. Survivors include his three daughters, Andrea Nevin of Brett, Beth Jass of Garner, and Carol Christensen of Jefferson. Brown Funeral Homes in Jefferson is handling arrangements. James Thomas of Clive. Jim passed away suddenly on Monday, November 23rd in Des Moines. Services will be held at a later date. Jim was born in Urbana, Iowa, to Lucille Reed Burkhart. He attended the Urbana Elementary until second grade when his family moved to Center Point. He graduated from Center Point High School in 1977. He received his bachelor's degree at Mount Mercy in Cedar Rapids and joined the U.S. Marine Reserves. On March 15, 1989, he married Joni Hall Thomas in La Crosse, Wisconsin. They have three children, Shannon, Jamie, Sean, and three grandchildren, Lydia, Riley, and Dallas, all of Des Moines. Jim was the store manager at Midwest Mattress in Des Moines. He enjoyed camping, fishing, the Green Bay Packers, and his family. He adored his grandkids. Survivors include his wife, children and grandchildren, sisters, Diane and husband Tom Ashiels of Omaha, and Sarah Thomas of Cedar Rapids. He was preceded in death by his grandparents, Lindley and Nina Reed, and his mom. He was loved by all. A GoFundMe account has been established for memorial donations. Bruce Hoffmeyer of Newton. Bruce Hoffmeyer, age 77, of Newton, died on Friday, November 20th at Mercy One Newton Medical Center in Newton. A private family funeral mass will be held. A Facebook Live broadcast of the service will begin at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, November 28th, at the Pence Reese Funeral Home and Cremation Services Facebook page. A public celebration of Bruce's life will be held during the summer of 2021. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be designated to the Mercy One Foundation, Sacred Heart Church, or the Newton YMCA and may be made online or left at the Pence Reese Funeral Home. And now we'll move to the sports page. Randy Peterson writes, "Believe it, ISU one win from Big 12 title game. Dateline Austin, Texas. An Iowa State victory for the ages? You bet. What unfolded at Darrell K. Royal Texas Memorial Stadium Friday likely put Matt Campbell's team in the Big 12 title game. That, combined with the fact that the Cyclones winning at Texas doesn't happen often, that's why it's a victory for the ages. Breece Hall's 3-yard touchdown burst through the middle of the line with 1:25 left to play gave number 15 Iowa State a 23-20 lead, its first advantage of the game and the game-winning score, but there was one bit of business left to finish. The Cyclones still had to play defense during what became the Campbell's regime's most significant drive. Hold the Longhorns to a tie and hold your break in overtime. A touchdown means Iowa State disaster. Jaquan Bailey sacking talented quarterback Sam Ellinger for a 4-yard loss, and then the Iowa State sidelines holding collective breaths as Cameron Dicker's 58-yard field goal attempt just missed to the left. Oh yeah, victory for the ages. I don't think we put any goals and expectations other than, man, can we not be the laughingstock of college football? Coach Matt Campbell responded when I asked if a shot at the Big 12 championship seemed feasible in just 5 seasons as the coach. It took me a while, once we got here, to figure out what we were from a perception standpoint. How do we do a great job in giving this program the opportunity to be the best version that we can be? By not flinching, that's how. By making great plays when great plays needed to be made, that's how. With a bunch of seniors who came to Iowa State when the program was near its lowest, that's how. And by overcoming mistakes that would have been enough to make a lot of Iowa State teams of the past have nothing left for successful game-playing ending plays, that's how. The Longhorns took over their 23, 77 yards to go in a very short amount of time after Hall's burst made it a 3-point game. First play, Texas Holding. First play, part two, incomplete pass after a thumping of a hit by Tavon Kyle. Second play, a pass completion to the 22, and now it's 3rd and 11. Third play, first down, completion to the Texas 34. Another Longhorns completion and then another brought the ball to the Iowa State's 43, and Texas called timeout with 27 seconds left to play. Ellinger scrambled out of a sack and was first down Longhorns at the Iowa State 36. Incomplete pass, and now there's 13 seconds left in regulation. Another incompletion, and the clock ticks down to 10 seconds. Latrell Bankston sacked Ellinger, and on fourth down from the Longhorns 40, Dicker lined up for a 58-yard goal attempt. Predictably, Iowa State called timeout. The kick wasn't good. Iowa State players stormed the field in jubilation. Oh yeah, an Iowa State victory for the ages. The Cyclones are now 7-1 in the Big 12 and 7-2 overall, with a game next Saturday at home against West Virginia remaining. Texas is out of the title hunt at 5-3. Oklahoma and Oklahoma State both have two league losses. Cyclones in the December 19th conference game at Jerry World beat West Virginia next Saturday, and it's a done deal. That's why this was a victory for the ages. "We don't ever flinch," said Greg Eisworth. "We were down 10 points early. We kept playing our game. We ended up pulling it out. It was 10-0 after Texas's first two possessions. The Cyclones' defense was on its heels. They hadn't yet adapted to the speed of the game against an opponent that hadn't played in 20 days. Iowa State crept back, but it was 20-10 Longhorns with 7.5 minutes in the third quarter. I looked over to the Cyclones' side of the field. I saw it. Senior tight end Chase Allen working the sidelines, Bailey too, and Eisworth. Those seniors weren't about to leave Austin in bad moods. It's happened so many times for this program, and they weren't having anything of it. The troops rallied. Plays that went haywire in the first half went well in the second. Texas was on its heels. Advantage, Iowa State. It comes down to being a tough team," quarterback Brock Purdy said. "Things weren't going our way, but the amount of leadership we have, starting with Coach Campbell, that leadership was off the charts. Big 12 title game in Purdy's third year as a starter. That's what I came here for," Purdy said. "Coach Campbell talked to me about what he envisioned this program to be. I believed in it right from the first moment I stepped on the field. That's why I came here." He didn't come to play for a laughingstock program. He came to Iowa State and to be successful in what Friday was, a victory for the ages. Chad Lysakow writes, "Special teams break tie and Iowa win versus Nebraska. Final score was Iowa 26, Nebraska 20. Dateline, Iowa City. Nebraska's defense came to play Friday afternoon at Kinnick Stadium, confusing and sometimes stifling an Iowa offense that had been rolling in the month of November. Iowa's stout defense had its moments against Nebraska's two-quarterback offense, but so did the Cornhuskers. Really, this Heroes Trophy was a hard-hitting and even battle, except for one area. Iowa dominated the special teams department Friday in every way. And as a result, the Hawkeyes wound up with more points on the scoreboard, 26-20, in earning their fourth straight win overall and sixth consecutive victory in the Nebraska series. Kirk Ferentz has always stressed the importance of good special teams in his 22-year tenure at Iowa, but he hasn't always had them. In 2014, the loss here to Nebraska in overtime, in which Iowa blew a 24-7 lead in overtime, is within the top five of the worst losses in Ferentz's career because the Hawkeyes gave up 134 punt return yards that day. That one is kind of burnt into my memory bank, unfortunately, Ferentz said after Friday's game. Probably never shake that one. But he hasn't had to experience a loss to Nebraska since. As Iowa football's Twitter account posted, it's been 2,191 days since the Huskers have beaten the Hawkeyes. On Friday, Ferentz could again thank his specialists and their coordinator, LeVar Woods, for extending the streak. First, the Huskers were so fearful of having Amir Smith-Marset beat them that they blooped all five kickoffs to about the 30-yard line. On only one of the 12 drives did Iowa start from inside its own 30. Second, punt returner Charlie Jones uncorked a 31-yard punt return in the first quarter. That set up one of two Iowa touchdowns for the day and boosted the Hawkeyes to a 10-0 advantage. Then there was the combination of Torrey Taylor and Terry Roberts in Iowa's punt game. Taylor punted twice. His first pinned Nebraska at its own 2-yard line. His second was a game changer, which floated with unusual spin, according to coverman Roberts. Nebraska returner Cam Taylor-Britt mishandled it, and Roberts recovered at Nebraska's 38 with 10:15 remaining in a 23-20 game. Shout out to them. They gave us a good fight, Robert said, but Coach Woods told us all week, at some point, they'll put one on the ground, and they put one on the ground for us. Lastly, and fittingly, give credit again to Keith Duncan. No Hawkeye is better at stirring the pot than the reigning consensus All-American. Last year, Duncan delivered a kiss after his first field goal kicked Iowa to a 27-24 victory in Lincoln. This year, he recovered 4 field goals and some more post-game shade. Duncan reported that Nebraska players were chirping at him during pregame warm-ups. They referenced reports that Husker players were growing mustaches in advance of the Iowa game. They like talking a little bit. I think they're too worried about growing mustaches than playing football, Duncan said, but that's the difference between Iowa and Nebraska. Duncan's biggest kick in the game and the year was a 48-yarder to start the fourth quarter that broke a 2020 tie, and it flew with as much power and accuracy as the 49-yarder he kicked a year ago with 1 second left in Lincoln. He added a pure 37-yarder with 8:21 left to play to make it 26-20. However, Duncan missed a chance to be the put-away hero, hitting the crossbar on a 51-yard try with 2:02 left. It would have been good from 50. Didn't hit it well and missed, Duncan said. Fortunately, we have a great defense that backs us up. Indeed, the special teams needed help to close the door, and the defense did the honors. Nebraska had reached Iowa's 39-yard line with 1:30 to go, but Chauncey Golston slammed into Martinez as he went to throw. The ball jarred loose, and Zach Van Valkenburg scooped up his 4th fumble recovery of the season, the 3rd in 2 weeks. Victory formation, Iowa. Victory polka. And one phone call needing to be placed from Duncan. An uncle on his father's side is a Huskers fan. He sent me a picture before the game. He was wearing his Nebraska gear under his Iowa gear, and I'm thinking, that's a little foreshadowing with Iowa on top, Duncan said. It's going to be an interesting conversation in about 10 minutes. I can't wait to rub it in his face a little bit. The Hawkeyes weren't dominant like they were the last 3 weeks. Their offense was outgained for the first time this season. Their defense had their 12-game streak with an interception stopped, but they all deserved to celebrate after improving to 4-2. Rivalry wins are rarely easy. This actually was Iowa's largest victory margin in the 3-year Scott Frost era at Nebraska. In all 3 wins, the deciding points came off the foot of the Hawkeye kicker. These are the games you need to build winning streaks in rivalries. The next scheduled Iowa-Nebraska game is November 6th in Lincoln. By then, the tally will be 2,535 days since the last Huskers win against Iowa. The locker room today is unreal. The kind of momentum we want to build on, Duncan said. Iowa football grows every single week. We get better every single week, and that's what we're best at. Chad Lysakow also writes, Ferentz scoffs at clapping complaints, Dateline Iowa City. Trophy game wins have gotten Kirk Ferentz a bit squirrely on 2 of the past 3 Fridays. Ferentz couldn't believe his ears when officials told him during Iowa's 26-20 win against Nebraska that the Cornhuskers' snaps were being thrown off by Hawkeye players on the sideline clapping during the game. Please, Ferentz said, in what began a post-game rant from a coach normally known for his reserved comments and opponent praise. Nebraska center Cam Jurgens struggled with several errant snaps in the first half, one of which resulted in a 19-yard loss in the second quarter. Third-year Nebraska coach Scott Frost said he alerted officials to the issue and they relayed the concerns to Ferentz. Once Iowa players stopped clapping, Frost said, the center snaps got better. Ferentz, who collected his 101st Big Ten Conference win, responded with borderline indignity. What the hell are we talking about? It's stupid. I have no idea, Ferentz said, and I know this. I saw across the field Nebraska had a little clap routine for third downs or something. I don't know. This is stuff in my 22nd year. I've never been thinking about that. Never heard of it. Now, if a player on the field was doing it to try to disrupt the snap, I get that. But what are we talking about? The next thing you know, we're going to be treating this like golf, where nobody's allowed to say anything. It was 2 Fridays earlier that Ferentz called back-to-back-to-back timeouts when Minnesota coach P.J. Fleck was leaving his first team offense on the field in the final moments of a 35-0 game against Iowa's second and third teamers. After winning the Floyd of Rosedale Trophy for the sixth straight year, Ferentz added, "Figured we'd take Floyd with us and leave the timeouts here." Maybe it's because both trophy games were on Friday, but the more common theme was that Ferentz was annoyed by what was coming from the opposite sideline. And at age 65, he doesn't seem to be holding back anymore. The only other topic that gets him this riled up in press conferences is the NCAA's rules on cut blocking. To finish the conversation, Ferentz said that if players clapping were really disrupting Nebraska, maybe they need to change their cadence. It's football, he continued. Are they okay with how I dress today? Should I be changing my pants or into a different shirt? What are we talking about? Significant second half plays Friday were made by, you guessed it, Davion Nixon. While the game-clinching defensive play was a tandem effort from defensive ends Chauncey Golston on the sack and Zach Van Valkenburg on the fumble recovery, with 1 minute 18 seconds to play, Nixon was at the center of Iowa's defense turnaround in the second half. After the teams traded touchdowns to open the third quarter to make it 20-20, Iowa's defense needed a spark, and the ever-energetic Nixon provided one as Martinez looked to have lots of room to run on a second and sixth quarterback draw. But Nixon's cat-quick reflexes in a 305-pound frame tracked down Martinez for a one-yard loss, the first big defensive stop for the Hawkeyes in a while. That forced a third and long that Martinez couldn't get with his legs and proved to be the last Nebraska offensive play of the third quarter. The next time Nebraska had the ball, as Martinez sprung free for what looked like another big run, Nixon drew a holding flag, his presence again impacting the game. Nebraska had to punt. By the time the Huskers got the ball back, again, they were down 6 points. Nixon finished the day with 8 tackles, including 3 for lost yardage. He should be in on the conversation for All-American honors as Iowa's leader in sacks with 5 and tackles for loss, 11.5 during 6 games. Ferentz again backed Spencer Petras as his starter after another rocky performance Friday. Petras seemingly replicated his performance in the Minnesota win, sharp in the first quarter, shaky in the second 2 quarters, then a decent finish to the game. After going 8-for-11 for 95 yards in the first quarter with a nice 6-yard touchdown toss to Tyrone Tracy, Petras went 10-for-19 for 98 yards the rest of the way and threw a regrettable interception to Caprio Booty in the second quarter that turned into 3 Nebraska points. Petras scrambled to his left and threw against his body toward Sam Laporta, but the ball was picked off easily. "Can't do that, just forced it," Petras said, obviously very upset because we take pride in taking care of the football. That's my number one job. It's to limit my turnovers. Can't do stuff like that. But credit to our defense for keeping them to a field goal. Petras also missed wide-open crossing routes to Tracy and Emir Smith-Marset Jr. in the third quarter that would have brought out the Boo Birds had Kinnick Stadium welcomed fans. The interception was a bad decision. And then there were a couple of times where he's aiming the football, Ferentz said, just all part of that growth process. It would be great if Iowa gets an opportunity at some point to get backup Alex Padilla into the game just to see what he can do with extended snaps, but obviously Friday's tense game was not that time for Ferentz. "We feel good about what Petras is doing. I think Alex has improved as well. Those are the 2 guys getting all the work basically in practice," Ferentz said, basically dismissing those in the fan base that are ready for the Deuce Hogan era. "We don't have any plans or discussions to make any changes there." Back in 2006, there was a new coach in the Big Ten Conference leading his alma mater. He had hopes of bringing that program back into prosperity from his own playing days. His team started 0-5 in Big Ten play, but came to Kinnick Stadium in November and recorded a breakthrough win, stunning Drew Tate and the Hawkeyes by a score of 21-7. That coach was Pat Fitzgerald at Northwestern, and it was that win that started an upward trend from the Wildcats that saw them win 9 games just 2 years later. Fitzgerald's stability continues today with a 5-0 Northwestern on a fast track to the Big Ten West Division title. It was Fitzgerald's ability to get a fledgling team to rise up in 2006, perhaps similar to Kirk Ferentz's ability to get Iowa to break through with encouraging wins in 2000. It is the type of thing Nebraska has been missing under Scott Frost. The vision for Frost when he was hired on December 3rd, 2017, was to carry his alma mater to longtime success. But Frost left Kinnick Stadium with a .345 winning percentage, 10-19, and continued struggles to get the Huskers to achieve that turn-the-corner type of win. To date, Nebraska's best win might be a 9-6 verdict against a 7-win Michigan State team in 2018 or this year's home win versus winless Penn State. And while the pandemic year is unusual, to say the least, that big breakthrough moment hasn't been there for Frost. All that's left on the schedule are games against Purdue and Minnesota, hardly needle movers like a win at Iowa would have been. This is normally the time of year we have narrowed Iowa's bowl destination to a small handful of options, but this year, of course, is far from normal. On Friday, the Pinstripe Bowl became the third postseason game with a Big Ten tie-in to cancel its game, joining the Red Box and Quick Lane. Iowa Athletics Director Gary Barta said during the pregame radio show that he's been talking to bowl people, but primarily to get a feel for which games might play and which won't. An unusual year when it comes to bowl games, Barta said. At this point, I've not thought a lot about that. Outside of the New York's 6 lineup, which is selected by the College Football Playoff Committee, the Big Ten's remaining bowl tie-ins are the Guaranteed Rate Bowl in Phoenix on December 26th, Duke's Mayo Bowl in Charlotte on December 30th, the Transperfect Music City Bowl in Nashville on December 30th, the Verbo Citrus Bowl in Orlando on January 1st, and the Outback Bowl in Tampa on January 2nd. Given that the NCAA has no minimum win requirements and it's 2020, anything surely could and will happen when it comes to bowl lineups. Travis Hines writes, ISU rejects its history, sits in first in Big 12. Dateline Austin, Texas. Some programs stand on the shoulders of past success to reach the heights of college football. When Matt Campbell surveyed the situation at Iowa State 5 years ago, it was evident that would not be the case for his new program. Coach Dan McCarney was such a great anchor here and gave hope to this program, Campbell said, of the Cyclone head coach who ran the program from 1995 to 2006. What they did in the 70s with Coach Earl Bruce, Johnny Majors, there were some pillars to build on, but some of these moments we had to learn the hard way. The hard way included a 3-9 season. It meant late season stumbles. It meant disappointment and frustration. The hard way, though, led here. Number 15 Iowa State is alone in first place and all but guaranteed to play its first ever Big 12 championship game after coming from behind to beat number 21 Texas 23-20 on Saturday afternoon at Darrell K. Royal Texas Memorial Stadium. We've learned so much along the way, and when you start at square one and it's hard to go back to some of the traditional pieces of how do you do it, Campbell said. The greatest thing that has allowed this team and our coaching staff and myself is to put ego away, really evaluate and try to figure out how do you chart a course to become the best version of yourself that you can be. I think every group has given us a chance to grow every year. I think this group's been able to take some of the lessons we've learned, both positive and negative, and really apply them to becoming the best version of themselves that they can be. Saturday's was a game that Iowa State has seemingly played in before. The game was so much at stake in adversity, front and center. The Cyclones historically, both for decades and under Campbell, have watched the opponent make the plays that matter. Not this time. Iowa State fell behind 10-0 in the first quarter, and it looked as though the Cyclones were on their heels and being shoved toward a cliff, the bottom of which was littered with the near misses of years past. The Cyclones, though, pushed back. Brock Purdy found Sean Shaw for a 35 yard touchdown to dial down the pressure. The Cyclones matched field goals with Texas to end the first half. Iowa State then saw promising drives falter in the second half, but still were able to salvage points, getting two field goals from Connor Astley. Then in the fourth quarter, Texas had two drives that could have put the Cyclones away. Rather than surrender the score that would have sent Iowa State back to Ames with a loss and severely damaged title game prospects, the Cyclones delivered a fourth down stand and forced a three and out. 69 yards from the end zone and 3 minutes, 9 seconds on the clock, Iowa State had a chance to win the ballgame. I feel like we've been in a bunch of situations throughout the year, even last year, Purdy said. We've been in these kinds of games where it feels like it comes down to a couple of points. Everyone just believed in one another on that drive we had to score. And that's what Iowa State did, with Breece Hall slicing in from 3 yards out to put the Cyclones up 23-20. Texas still had a chance to tie or win the game, and again, Iowa State had an answer. Latrell Bankston's sack with 3 seconds left forced a 57-yard field goal attempt, which missed left. So many opportunities when things could have gone wrong, but instead went right for Iowa State. It went against the script that Iowa State football has followed for years. Not that the Cyclones haven't recorded big wins before, but they've never done it and rarely been in the situation when it mattered most. That changed in a stadium ringed with reminders about conference and national championships from decades prior. It's five-star culture, Hall said, versus five-star players. A culture built from the ground up and reached by taking the hard way that now has Iowa State surveying the Big 12 below them. Now we'll move to the Iowa Life section. Our first article comes from Sierra Porter. Des Moines Symphony's New Year's Eve celebration moves online. The Des Moines Symphony is converting the remainder of its 2020-2021 season to virtual concerts because of the ongoing uncertainty of the COVID-19 pandemic. The symphony had planned to resume in-person performances with a New Year's Eve Pops Gala featuring the music of Elton John, performed by keyboardist and singer Michael Cavanaugh. But now the New Year's Eve celebration will be a free virtual show with the host's former KCCI anchors, Kevin and Molly Cooney, presenting highlights from previous performances. It will be available on the Des Moines Symphony website and its YouTube channel. On the site, supporters can choose extra cost event participation packages, such as a musician meet and greet and dinner package. Ticket holders for the New Year's Eve Pops 2020 will receive tickets to next year's concerts, while patrons with tickets for Masterworks concerts through May of 2021, which also has been planned to be in person, will have access to streaming live from the temple performances. Fans have the option to donate their tickets back to the symphony or request a refund by emailing info@dmpa.org. Surrounding each of the five Masterworks shows will be a week of classes, virtual social events, prelude talks, and more. Performing in a different space and configuration is a unique challenge, but also a wonderful opportunity, Des Moines Symphony music conductor and director Joseph Giunta said in a news release. Dance, rhythm, and blues from Stravinsky's History to Scott Joplin's The Entertainer, a program that spans a history of dance music, will be presented January 21st. Past and Present, a study in past and present from Haydn to St. George to Jesse Montgomery's modern multicultural tribute to the Star-Spangled Banner, will be presented February 11th. The Spring Serenade, enjoy Richard Strauss's Serenade in E-flat major and works by Mozart and others, will be presented March 18th. Fireworks and Fanfare, Handel and Piazzolla begin and end an evening of brass and percussion music featuring modern fanfares and solemn chorals. That will be presented April 15th. French Fantasy, principal flautist James Blanchard plays. The orchestra will also perform the Allegro from Mozart's Paris Symphony. That will be presented May 13th. Carmina Burana, Bernadette Peters in concert, Cheetah and Friends in concert, and Revolution, the Music of the Beatles have all been postponed to the 2021-2022 season. previously issued tickets will be valid for rescheduled dates, and patrons will be notified when performances are confirmed by both the artist and the venue. Concert and event passes can be purchased online at dmsymphony.org. There are three photographs that accompany this article. The first one's caption reads, Des Moines Symphony Orchestra music director and conductor Joseph Giunta leads musicians during rehearsal September 29th at the Temple for Performing Arts in Des Moines, and it shows him wearing a mask. The second photo's caption reads, Des Moines Symphony Orchestra violinist Dana Pins warms up prior to rehearsal on September 29th at the Temple for Performing Arts in Des Moines, and again, it shows her wearing a mask. And finally, the third photograph caption reads, Aaron Brooker Miller warms up at a Des Moines Symphony Orchestra rehearsal on September 29th at the Temple for Performing Arts, and it shows her wearing a mask as well. The next article is titled, Five Tips for Boarding Your Pets During the Holidays. To help you feel more comfortable leaving your dogs or cats at a boarding facility, follow these five tips from Dr. Jen Kasten, Technical Services Veterinarian at Tomlin Veterinary Science, a maker of pet supplements and products. 1. Find a facility. Boarding facilities have changed over the years. Do your research to find a facility that meshes well with your and your animal's needs before making a commitment. You might be surprised to find that some luxury pet boarding facilities offer add-on items such as a daily play group time, in-suite webcams, and specialty treats like doggy ice cream or grilled sirloin steak. 2, introduce your pet to the facility. If your pet has never stayed overnight in a new location, call the boarding facility to see if you can schedule a walkthrough or even a trial one-night stay. While there, provide your pet with positive reinforcement so the experience becomes enjoyable. 3, ask questions. During your visit to the facility, ease your mind and ensure you're selecting the best place for your animal by asking important questions such as, who is responsible for the daily care? Is someone available 24/7 to check on the welfare of the animals in boarding? What is the protocol in the event of emergencies? Are any vaccinations and medical records required for a stay? Is there time provided for socialization and/or training? 4, send them with something familiar. It's especially important to leave pets with small items that will remind them of home and make them feel more comfortable in a new environment. Consider bringing a favorite bed, blanket, toy, or even one of your old pieces of clothing. The familiar scents on these items can make them feel more comfortable throughout their stay. And finally, 5, make your departure as painless as possible. Leaving your pet is the most difficult part, but try to make a quick departure. Animals can sense our stress, so if you remain calm, it will help them feel more comfortable in their new temporary environment. An automotive tech article comes from Jamie LaRue for Detroit Free Press, and it's titled Digital Plates on the Road. Digital license plates have been allowed in California and Arizona since 2019, and now they are allowed in Michigan, too, but not yet for sale. At a starting price of nearly $500 a plate, with a $55 yearly connectivity fee, only 3,300 people have them in California and Arizona. The company that created them, Revivir, is in discussions with 11 other states, including Michigan, to offer the plates. Revivir expects to begin selling its digital license plates in Michigan during the spring when the digital license plate can access roadside assistance. It's also a virtual wallet for your car. I can see a future where you can pay at Starbucks with it. The plates display computer-generated imagery using technology that is similar to an e-reading tablet. Revivir offers two digital license plates. The basic plate, which is battery-operated, is called R plate. It uses Bluetooth connectivity and the battery will last 5 years. The R plate enables electronic vehicle registration renewal and eliminates the need for stickers. Now we'll take a look at the nation's health section of the USA Today from Friday. First article is from Adriana Rodriguez. It's titled, Will Other Holidays in the US Be Better? Fauci worries about rise in COVID-19 cases. Anthony Fauci suggested Thanksgiving may be the beginning of a dark holiday season, as the surge in coronavirus cases is likely to persist or even get worse through December, January, and February. If the surge takes a turn of continuing to go up, and you have the sustained greater than 100,000 infections a day and 1,300 deaths per day, and the count keeps going up and up. I don't see it being any different during the Christmas and New Year's holidays than during Thanksgiving, he said in an interview with USA Today last week. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases director said the country is in a vulnerable position heading into the holiday season because infections are too high to control surges when they arise, as he is confident that they will in the winter months. Fauci said he's most likely scrapping Christmas plans this year, as he did for Thanksgiving. Instead of receiving his three daughters this year, he opted to send his love over Zoom and enjoyed a quiet dinner with his wife. For my own family, I'm saying we had a really great Thanksgiving and Christmas last year. We're looking forward to a really great Thanksgiving and Christmas in 2021, he said. Let's now make the best of the situation and show our love and affection for people by keeping them safe. But nearly 3 million air travelers passed through security checkpoints on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday before Thanksgiving. Sunday was the single busiest day at airport checkpoints since March. Ali Mokhtad, professor of health metrics sciences at the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluations and chief strategy officer for population health at the University of Washington, said only about a fourth of COVID-19 cases are reported in the U.S. because testing is still not readily available to everyone and mild forms of the disease go undetected. The number of new COVID-19 cases earlier this week averaged about 175,000 a day, according to Johns Hopkins University figures. But the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluations recently estimated there are about twice as many cases as reported, and projected more than 450,000 daily cases by December 25th if trends continue. We should prevent getting COVID-19, especially at this time when we're about to get a vaccine rolling out, Mokhtad said. We need to be extra careful these upcoming extra couple of weeks in order to avoid pain and suffering. As COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths continue to rise nationwide, states are imposing new coronavirus-related restrictions. Several are putting limits on social gatherings, adding states to travel quarantine lists, mandating face masks, and encouraging residents to stay home. Jody Guest, professor and vice chair of the Department of Epidemiology at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University, said the country probably won't see the benefits of these new restrictions by the holidays. Everything we do has implications 4 to 6 weeks out, she said. These prevention measures will keep people alive for the holidays, but I don't think they're a license to go have Christmas and Hanukkah parties the way that we have in previous years. Although there isn't much data available on small gatherings, experts speculate that they could be a major driver of the pandemic, especially when they include multiple households. Given the cold weather and given the fact that these types of celebrations, as wonderful and beautiful and traditional as they are fundamentally indoor things with people who will be singing and laughing and eating and drinking, you've just got to be careful, Fauci said. However, there's one tradition that Fauci says is safe to uphold, Santa. He's naturally immune to the coronavirus, which means he can safely deliver presents on Christmas Eve. Santa is exempt from this because Santa, of all the good qualities, has a lot of good innate immunity, Fauci said. So, Santa is not going to be spreading any infections to anybody. In the Coronavirus News Digest, CDC, U.S. misses 8 cases for every one counted. The United States is still severely undercounting the number of COVID-19 cases it has across its population, a new Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report says. The CDC calculated that about 53 million Americans had been infected by the end of September, 8 times below the confirmed cases at this time. A previous CDC report had estimated the U.S. was undercounting cases by 10 times the amount. Of the 53 million estimated infections, the CDC says about 45 million were sick at some point, about 2.4 million were hospitalized. Ohio's former top health official calls COVID-19 a humanitarian crisis. Dr. Amy Acton, the surging pandemic is the public health equivalent of the Titanic, and not all Ohioans will be able to get on a lifeboat in the end. You can't turn the Titanic on a dime, said Acton, former director of the Ohio Department of Health. So we're going down. It's some amount of going down. So let's minimize the amount. When the pandemic first hit Ohio, Acton, an epidemiologist at Ohio State University, predicted the state could eventually report around 10,000 new COVID-19 infections per day. Those projections never came to fruition during Acton's tenure. Nearly 8 months later, though, Ohio surpassed Acton's projection, reporting 11,885 new cases on Monday. "We're going to face a moment here. I think it's going to peak within the next 2 weeks," she said. That comes from Max Philby from the Columbus Dispatch. Missouri doctor's video recreates what COVID-19 patients see at the end. Dr. Kenneth Remy knows the toll the pandemic has taken on the U.S., and he's confident things will get better in 2021 with a vaccine. "First, the country needs to get through the winter, and that means adhering to precautions like wearing a mask," he said. That's why Remy, a researcher at Washington University in St. Louis and a physician at Barnes Jewish Hospital and St. Louis Children's Hospital, made a video to stress the point. It is a first-person view of what it's like to be intubated while breathing too fast. "You're lying in that bed, looking up at me and others in the room," he said. "It simulates basically what it looks like to breathe and then, frankly, what it looks like for me to come at you with an endotracheal tube and a laryngoscope." He added, "For some patients, that's all they see at the end of their life. They see that, they get some medicines, and they never awaken again." And finally, coronavirus postpones national math and reading achievement tests until 2022. A national reading and math test that has long been used to track U.S. student achievement is the latest postponement amid the coronavirus pandemic, officials announced Wednesday. Concerns over the accessibility of the National Assessment of Educational Progress have postponed the test to 2022, the National Center for Education Statistics said. The test, typically occurring every 2 years, has been slated for 2021 for hundreds of thousands of the country's fourth and eighth graders. The national assessments are given to a representative sample of students from all socioeconomic backgrounds across the 50 states. It is overseen by the government. A fact check comes from Camille Caldera for the USA Today. Official did not suggest mandatory vaccinations. After coronavirus vaccine candidates from Pfizer and Moderna showed up to 95% efficacy, officials from Operation Warp Speed, the White House-led initiative to quickly develop COVID-19 vaccines and treatments, provided an update about their efforts to assist with vaccine production and distribution. Army General Gustav Perna, the chief operating officer for Operation Warp Speed, provided extensive information about vaccine distribution plans at a panel on November 18th. Full footage of the update is available from the Department of Defense and C-SPAN. Erin Elizabeth, an author and public speaker, is also known as HealthNet News, posted a 1 minute clip of his remarks on Facebook and Instagram. "All of America must receive the vaccine within 24 hours of distribution. There is no have and have not," she wrote, quoting the video. Elizabeth added that she's not a fan of Operation Warp Speed and is not too thrilled about the idea of mandated coronavirus vaccines. Brianna Janelle, who also posted a short clip of the panel on Facebook, highlighted phrases from Perna uttered, including "all of America must receive." "Nope, don't like that," she wrote. Elizabeth and Janelle had not responded to requests from USA Today for comment. Comments were in reference to access. The posts both emphasized the quote, "all of America must receive the vaccine within 24 hours of distribution," but Perna was not referring to mandated vaccination or even receiving the vaccination on an individual level. He was talking about the importance of quickly distributing the vaccine to each of the nation's 64 jurisdictions, including the 50 states, 8 territories, and 6 major metropolitan areas. "Distribution will occur from our fill-finish site and will go to all 64 jurisdictions that we are responsible to ensure they get vaccine for within 24 hours. Everybody, every jurisdiction will have immediate access," he said. At the end of his remarks, Perna summarized his previous points and shared what he told his team are the two things we must have. That's when he said the quote in the post. "One, upon emergency use authorization, all of America must receive vaccine within 24 hours, as I said. I think this is incredibly important, fair and equitable distribution of the vaccine throughout the country simultaneously. There is no haves and have-nots, he continued. It is an equitable distribution, and we are driving hard to make sure that that happens. In context, he is clearly talking about the necessity of quick and fair vaccination distribution across America, not mandating vaccines. Our rating, missing context. Based on our research, the claim that an official with Operation Warp Speed said all of America must receive the vaccine within 24 hours of distribution is rated missing context, because without additional context, it is misleading. It's a bona fide quote from Army General Gustav Perna, but his comments were in reference to the necessity of immediate vaccine access and equitable distribution across the nation, not mandatory vaccination. Shefala Luthra, writing for the USA Today, study, suicidal thoughts rise after pregnancy. Suicide accounts for 6.5% of all pregnancy-related deaths in the U.S. Suicide is a leading cause of pregnancy-related deaths in the U.S. A new study shows that the number of people having suicidal thoughts after giving birth increased from 2006 to 2017. The biggest spikes among people who are Black, lower income, or younger. The study, published November 18th in JAMA Psychiatry, looked at almost 600,000 privately insured people. Researchers analyzed the data to track cases of suicidality, suicidal ideation, and deliberate self-harm within a year, either before or after giving birth. From 2006 to 2017, suicidality diagnoses increased from 0.2% per 100 people to 0.6% per 100. In the same period, cases of self-harm went up 0.1% per 100 in 2006 to 0.2% per 100 in 2017. When applied to the approximately 4 million births each year, this means an increase in tens of thousands of suicidal cases and self-harm. Suicidality is something that we don't think about or talk about as much, and it's a lot more common than I realized, said Kara Zevin, a professor at the University of Michigan and the paper's senior author. Zevin pursued the research based on her own experience 10 years ago after giving birth to her son. Her postpartum depression made her suicidal. The U.S. rate of pregnancy-related deaths is higher than any other wealthy nation, according to a report by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In 2017, suicide accounted for about 6.5% of all pregnancy-related deaths. It's not clear what is behind the trend, though the researcher said it probably is a combination of doctors more often catching cases, which is typically underdiagnosed, and the growing problem is just becoming more common. Zivin said the study makes a strong case for policy interventions that ensure people can access mental health care during and after pregnancy. People who have Medicaid as their insurance when pregnant will lose that eligibility after 60 days of birth in most states, even though suicide a year after giving birth is still considered pregnancy-related. Zivin suggested states or the federal government could extend Medicaid to guarantee insurance for a year postpartum, making sure more people can see mental health specialists. The study found that Black people experienced the largest increase in perinatal suicidality of any racial group, increasing from 0.2% per 100 in 2006 to 0.9% in 2017. The nation's pregnancy-related death rate is far higher for Black people than for white people. That's probably an undercount of the gap, said an associate professor at the University of Minnesota and director of the Rural Health Research Center. Black women are disproportionately covered through Medicaid, not private insurance. Author said it's not clear why Black people experience such a dramatic increase in diagnoses. Experiences of racism have been linked to physical stress and mental illness symptoms. Dear Abby, prenup becomes roadblock on couple's journey to the altar. Dear Abby, I have a delightful, caring, loving man in my life. We knew each other years ago when we were married to other people. 3 years ago, after a couple of years of courtship, he asked me to move in. We are great together. He has embraced my two children, and especially my two grandchildren, as he had none from his previous marriage. Because I bring more to his life than anyone, I proposed to him 7 months ago, and he said yes. We talked, and he requested a prenup, which is fine with me, because his ex took a large sum of cash. I've asked a few times since the proposal if he has talked to his cousin, who is an attorney he trusts, but I don't believe this is moving along. because you cannot make anyone do anything they are not inclined to do, I have stopped asking. He knows I need financial security. I have always done right by him. That is who I am. At this point, I'm enjoying my life of privilege with my doctor companion, who loves me dearly but can't seem to honor our relationship and take the next step. Am I right to let it be? Waiting for now. Dear Waiting, I agree that you cannot make anyone do anything that they are not inclined to do. Because drafting the prenuptial agreement appears to be stalled, raise the subject again and ask if he regrets accepting your proposal or if he's ready to move forward. He may like things just as they are, and if you need more than that, what he is willing to give, you may have to move on. 3 years is enough time to decide if he wants to make your romance permanent. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register for Saturday, November 28th, 2020. You can hear the show again at 6 p.m. and again at 1 a.m. Recordings are available on our website, iowaradioreading.org. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of Iowans who are print disabled. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 515-243-6833. You can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa, 1-877-404-4747. Once again, we want you to know that our program schedule has changed so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m. 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. And the Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with the schedule until further notice. I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch, and it's been a pleasure to read for you today. Stay tuned for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and thank you for listening to Your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.